Good night, Shabbos, everyone. Welcome back to our 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes as we have upgraded to, what do we call them now? Not chili dogs, they're chulent dogs. For those who are listening online, you can envision that, what it looks like when you either dip your hot dog in a bowl of chulent or when you pile your chulent onto your hot dog, but whatever it takes. Listen, as we say, we are mitoch shalolishma bolishma shir, whatever it takes to get people in the room. All right, I want to thank both of our sponsors this week very, very much. Yossi and Gilda Mandel, in commemoration of the 49th yahrzeit of Yossi's father, which is on the 9th of Teves, Zecher Nishmas Yisrael Dov Ben Yosef Irving Mandel. Where's Yossi?
He's over there.
Thank you very much, not just for sponsoring, but for upgrading our sponsorship to deluxe hot dogs. Thank you very much. And to Dr. Michael and Marilyn Fedak, in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. We are very grateful to the Fedaks as well for their sponsorship. And as always, our learning should be an aliyah for the neshama of Esther Tehila Bas Gavriel Pinchas. As I was heading out the door tonight, my wife said to me, which is your favorite idea? And I said, number one. So here we go. Although I've been known to pull audibles throughout this year, but at least start off, I'm going to say number one. Number one comes from the Sefer Acharei Ro'i, who writes the following. Pasuk says, Mikzeh Achav Lakach Hamisha Anashim Vayetzigim Lifnei Paro. When Yosef brings the brothers before Paro, the Pasuk tells us that he takes 5 out of the brothers. Why does he take 5 of the brothers? Why doesn't he take all of the brothers? So Rashi says, De Yosef Lakach HaChalashim Shebehem. Yosef takes the weakest of them. Why? Because he wants Paro to realize that they shouldn't be put to work, that they're just pathetic, eisvarv shepherds, and therefore he'll throw them in Goshen and not put them really to work. Okay, now how does Rashi know that these are the weakest of ones? So pay attention carefully. It's a little bit of a brain teaser here, especially for this hour of the night. That's why I have my little cheat sheet here, but I'm going to walk you through it. Here we go. Rashi says, Osam shelo huchbalu shmosam kishebircham Moshe. That at the end of his Osa Bracha, when Moshe is giving the brachos or recounting the brachos to all of the Shvatim, some of them he duplicates the names. He says the names a second time. Says Rashi, Osam shalohuch belush mosam. Those whose names were not repeated in Vizosa Bracha, those are the weaker ones. Okay? So according to Rashi, quoting the Medrash, those who are not repeated in Vizosa Bracha are the weaker ones, which means those who are repeated are the strong ones. Okay, good. But then he says, Aval, in my next underline, B'Gemara Bavlis, Shalanu, in the Gemara in Baba Kama, it says, Osam Shehuch Belush Mosam, Heima Chalashim. It says the exact opposite in the Gemara in Baba Kama. It says, those who are repeated are the weak ones, and those who are not repeated are the strong ones. Okay, so here we have a Machlokes, quotes the Sefer Acharei Ro'i, between Rashi, according to the Medrash here in our Parsha, and the Gemara and Baba Kama. Let's just review and repeat. This would be a lot better if I had a board here, but you'll take my word for it. According to Rashi in our Parsha, those that have their names repeated in Vizosa Bracha are the strong ones. Those who do not have their names repeated are the weak ones. According to the Baba Kama, it's the exact opposite. Those who have their names repeated are the weak ones, and those who do not have their names repeated are the strong ones. Okay, what in the world is going on here? What does it mean, repeated, not repeated? Why does it matter? Why is there this machlokas? Says the Sefer Acharei Ro'i so beautifully. He said, Delishitas HaMedrash, according to the Medrash, which Rashi is quoting, again, according to the Medrash, those who are repeated are the strong ones, not repeated are the weak ones. Hutzrach Moshe Rabbeinu lichbol osam shayu giborim. Moshe Rabbeinu had to repeat those that were the strongest, because those are the ones that were going to go into Eretz Yisrael, and the strong Shvatim were the ones who were going to wage battle. And so therefore, because they were the mighty ones, the military leaders, and because they were going to be sent into battle, and because they were the strong ones, so Moshe Rabbeinu repeats their name, because by repeating their name, he gives them a little bit of extra koach, he gives them a little bit of extra strength. And therefore, according to the Rashi, the ones in Vizosa Bracha that are repeated are the strong ones, indicated that they are going into Eretz Yisrael, and because they're going out to battle and they're the strong ones, they need extra strength, and therefore I'm going to repeat their name. So what about the Gemara in Baba Kama? He says, however, Lishita Sabavli, according to the Gemara in Baba Kama, where again, the ones that were repeated are the weak ones, Lehefich, it's the exact opposite. Didafka HaChalashim kefel shmosam. It's specifically the weak ones that have their names repeated. Litein lahem koach lilcho, to give them the ability to wage battle. Because they're weak, they're the ones who need the extra strength. Aval higiborim, but according to the Gemara and Baba Kama, the strong ones, lo hutzrach levarech, they don't need the extra bracha. Debalav hachi yecholim lilchom bekoach atzman, because without it, they're already strong, and therefore they don't need the extra bracha. Okay, that is the Sefer Acharei Ro'i. Again, let's just review. You have, according to Rashi, according to the Medrash, that the ones in Vizos HaBracha that are repeated are the strong ones. According to the Gemara Mabakama, the ones that are repeated are the weak ones. Says the Sefer Acharei, what's the machlokas about? Which ones needed reinforcement more? According to Rashi, the strong ones needed reinforcement more because they were the ones that were going to lead battle, so you have to give them the extra armor, you have to give them the extra strength. According to the Gemara and Baba Kama, no, the exact opposite. It's the weak ones that need the extra strength, dafka, because they're weak. The strong ones are strong altogether. What do they need anything extra for? I think based on this Acharei Ro'i, and I think he develops this idea, but it's not as clear in him, but I'm pretty sure this is where he's headed. I think there's a very fundamental machlokas that applies to every single one of us. And that is as follows. Do you, in life, reinforce your strengths or do you try to work on your weaknesses? In other words, if you're going to spend time working on something, do you play to your strengths and say, I'm good at this already, let me become excellent at that? Or do you look at your weakness and say that part of my avoda is to overcome those weaknesses and to build on those weaknesses? So for example, one of the books that I read, there's actually a book that is literally written all about, and he gives Michael Jordan as an example. He says, Michael Jordan was arguably one of the best basketball players ever to live. Okay? Michael Jordan, the second he started becoming a baseball player, what happened to him? He was an abject failure. It was a disaster. So what did he do? He went back to playing basketball. And what was he again? He was very successful again. So Michael Jordan was a successful basketball player. The second he tried to work on something that he wasn't good at, what just happened to him? He became terrible. And so therefore, there's a whole book out there that argues that instead of working on your weaknesses, you're much better off in life playing to your strengths, because that's where your natural proclivity and inclinations lie. That's where your talents and abilities lie anyways. And so by excelling at that, you can almost like accelerate that which you are amazing at. On the other hand, we have a whole slew of sources. For example, Rav Tzadok HaKohen writes in Sitka Sasadik that the avoda of a person in this world is dafka to take what they're bad at or what they're weakest at and to work on that. And if you want to know what your avoda in this world is, it's specifically to find the thing that you're weakest at and to build upon that. So that is a machlokas in life. If you're going to spend time, what are you better off spending time on? Building up your strengths or working on your weaknesses? And again, imagine if I polled people here, this chevra would fall on different sides of that equation. Perhaps that is this machlokas within the Acharei Ro'i between the Medrash, quoted by Rashi, and the Gemara and Baba Kama. According to the Medrash, the ones that were repeated were the strong ones. And if you read, remember, why did he say they were the strong ones going to battle? So he gave them extra koach because they're going to battle. In other words, you work on your strengths. That which you're good at, you work at and you build on and you become better and better and better at that, because that's going to accelerate your growth. And so therefore, it's dafka the giborim. It's specifically those that are strongest, where your strengths lie, that you invest most heavily in. On the other hand, you have the Gemara Baba Kama. And the Gemara Baba Kama says, no, it's the weaker ones that had to be repeated. The strong ones, they're strong anyways. It's specifically the weaker ones that needed their names repeated to be able to build them up. That would be the side of the argument that says, that which are your strengths, they're your strengths anyways. You're good at that anyways. You're naturally inclined to that. You're much better off, and you're going to grow much more if you specifically work on a weakness of yours. And if you're able to grow through that and break yourself, then you'll excel even more, because then not only will you have your strengths, but you'll also have turned your weakness into at least a neutral, if not a strength at all. And so perhaps this machlokas, first of all, fascinating enough to know the machlokas, but this machlokas between Rashi and the Gemara Baba Kama, perhaps is a machlokas in life, again, about whether or not we are supposed to build on our strengths and reinforce our strengths, and that's where we're going to excel the most, Or are we going to grow the most through compensating for our weaknesses and growing through our weaknesses? That's where we're going to build the most character, and that's where we're going to accelerate our growth. Yeah.
What does Rashi do with the weak guy? When you first started this, it was only my understanding that the weak guys didn't even go to battle. It was only the strong guys who went to battle. But if the Gemara of Kamsa says the weak guys also went to battle, then now you're leaving.
He's saying they're going to battle, but they're going to be in the back. In other words, okay, it's the strong, the guys in front that really need the energy. Right, they're not. They're the jobnikim in the back.
The question is, what does Baba Kama do with this story here?
What do you mean?
Because Rashi's linking this story to the what Moshe said later on. Maron Baba Kama doesn't link that story.
No, it's just it's going to define the weak ones differently. In other words, everyone agrees that he put the weak ones in front. The question is, who are the weak ones? Are the weak ones the ones that had their name repeated in Vizosa Bracha, or are the weak ones the ones that did not have their name repeated in Bracha?
I mean, there's a certain number of people.
Well, you have five and five either way. Right, Yosef, right.
Six and Binyamin, right? And then Judah is left out.
So it's five and five, because Yosef also.
Yosef.
Right, so you're five and five. So either way, it's five. Right. The question is, which are the five? That's exactly what we're trying to figure out. We know that the five weak ones, the question is, who are the weak ones? So Rashi says the weak ones are the ones that are not repeated. The Gemara Baba Kama says the weak ones are the ones that are repeated. And we want to know, what's this machlokas about? So again, based on the Acharei Ro'i, it boils down to, do you reinforce the strong ones, or do you let the strong ones be strong, and instead you reinforce the weaknesses? And I'm extrapolating upon that, and I'm pretty sure this is where he's headed with it, is in life, how do we approach it? Do we approach that we take our strengths and we become better at what we're good at, or do we take our weaknesses and grow through our weaknesses, which in many ways builds a sense of self-esteem? You know, it has other peripheral benefits as well. Okay, so that's idea number one, the Acharei Ro'i, based on this Pasuk, based on the Rashi, based on the Gemara Baba Kama, and I think a very fascinating conversation that you could have at your Shabbos table with children. Should you take what you're good at and become better at it, or should you specifically spend time in taking what you're weak at and cracking that? Because again, that can build you up in other ways as well. And again, I think that's a machlokes. I could show you sources on either way. Again, you have Tzidka Sasadik, who argues that you're going to grow the most through your weakness. I could quote you other sources in Torah and Musar Svarim that say, no, Dafka, take that which you're good at and become better at it. So that, I think, is a fascinating conversation. That is idea number one. Okay, idea number two comes from Rabbi Daniel Stein. This I'll put in a, not like a massive chiddush, but I love the way he packages it. Okay, so that's what we're going to call this one. He points out that obviously the entire story of Yosef unfolds because of jealousy, right? Yaakov specifically, or appears to love Yosef more than the other sons. He gives them the ketones pasim, and as a result, the other shvatim come to despise Yosef. Based on this, the Gemara in Shabbos, right in the middle of that first paragraph, concludes that a person should never distinguish one of his sons from amongst the other by giving him preferential treatment. For it is due to the weight of the two sell of fine wool that Yaakov gave Yosef that basically caused all of the jealousy and everything that unfolded in Mitzrayim. In fact, the Chasam Sofer quotes in the name of the Arizal that the word Yosef itself is the same numerical value as the word for kina, which means jealousy, to indicate that Yosef's very existence in the preferential treatment in which he was treated, is what aroused the jealousy and hatred of his brothers. Okay, so that we know, that the brothers hated Yosef because they were jealous. Yaakov perhaps may have misplayed that and creating that sense of jealousy, fine. Okay? And he asked the question, how could Yaakov Avinu not have foreseen that showering Yosef with special gifts and privileges would create resentment? Right? Like Yaakov didn't realize that if he was showering one of his children with gifts, that it was going to cause resentment with all the other children? Those are the previous parshios. Now we come to this week's parsha, because he points out that Yosef makes the exact same mistake that Yaakov made, that when it comes to Binyamin, the Pasuk tells us that he gives Binyamin five times the clothing that he gives the other Shvatim. And the Gemara in Megillah wonders, is it possible that the very thing from which Yosef had suffered, he himself should stumble by showing favoritism to Binyamin? How could it be that Yosef, who understood the catastrophic consequences of one parent showing favoritism to a child, and then he goes along and he makes the exact same mistake to Binyamin? Now, I would imagine, Lior, if you showed favoritism to one of your children, how would that go over in the house?
They already think
Guys, does your father favor one of you over the other?
No.
Who's no?
They think that their sisters.
Well, I know for sure which amongst me and my siblings are the favorite, and I'm pretty sure most of my siblings know also, and it's not me, but okay. And my children also may or may not sit at Shabbos meals debating which is their favorite. Of course, I love all my children equally, okay? So the question is, how could Yosef make the same mistake, right? That's the question on our Parsha. If Yaakov gets them into this mess by showing favoritism to Yosef, how is it that Yosef now shows favoritism to Binyamin and is creating the exact same thing? Then he points out that in next week's Parsha, Yaakov's going to make the same mistake again. Because when it's going to come to Ephraim and Asher, turn the page, page number 3. So again, Yaakov is going to single out Yosef's grandchildren, and he's going to say, Ephraim and Asher, you are like Reuven and Shimon to me. Did Yaakov not realize? Does Yaakov not realize, again, the catastrophic consequences of showing favoritism? What happened when he showed favoritism to Yosef? And now all of a sudden, he's going to, it's like redo. He's going to do it over again by making Yosef's grandchildren more by showing Yosef's children are going to be more precious, so to speak, than the other grandchildren? Like, how does that work? Hadn't he learned from the episode of Yosef and his brothers to treat everyone in the family equally? So basically what Rabbi Stein does is he develops that this is a pattern. This is a question that started 2 weeks ago and is going to continue to next week. How do you understand Yaakov and Yosef over and over again making this quote-unquote mistake of favoring either one set of children, one brother, one set of grandchildren, and yeah.
I mean, it's a Mesorah.
Goes back to Avram.
Yes. Well, I'll say that.
Okay, it goes back to Avram. That what?
You like Yitzchak, Yishmael, get away.
There he may have had a right.
Right. Okay, but still.
But certainly, I understand what you're saying. But certainly, within the context of these parshios, like when you read the parshios together as a package, specifically knowing what happens the moment Yaakov shows favoritism to Yosef, you would think that they would learn from that mistake, even within this package of the story. He writes here the following, to answer this. Page 3, first full paragraph. It seems that despite being taboo in our society, and particularly amongst children, to display any kind of treatment that is not equal or completely fair, there are certain instances where parental favoritism is acceptable and indeed required. For example, parents routinely give more attention to newborns than they do to other children. The same goes for children who are unfortunately ill or disabled. Parental favoritism becomes personal offensive when it is perceived as being arbitrary. It is obvious that parents must mold their parenting to specific circumstances, needs, and challenges of each individual child, even if it means channeling more time, energy, resources, attention, and affection towards that specific child at the expense of other siblings. I would venture to say all of us have had the experience where you treat one child or grandchild differently than another child or grandchild. And perhaps other of your children will say, I never got away with that. Or you never let me do that when I was a child. Or if I did that, you would, right? And then you try to explain to those children that each of the children are different. That what you needed may not be what they needed. And each of you, because you're different, I'm going to mold my parenting style to you. So it's not that I'm treating each of you arbitrarily different, but I'm recognizing that because each of you are different, therefore, my parenting or grandparenting is going to manifest itself differently to that child or grandchild. He writes here now beautifully. He says, Yaakov Avinu foresaw that Yosef would encounter unique challenges, different from those of the other Shvatim. In fact, Rashi writes that the word kesones pasim, spelled pei, samich, yud, mem, is an acronym for Potiphar, Socharim, which are the merchants, Yishmaelim, and Midyanim, corresponding to the tests that Yosef would face in the future. He was tempted by the wife of Potiphar, obviously sold into slavery. He would have to overcome all of these tests, and therefore, Yaakov treated Yosef differently, not because he loved Yosef anymore, but because he understood that Yosef would undergo certain challenges, and therefore he needed to prepare Yosef for the challenges. Same thing with Ephraim and Manasseh. Why does he treat Ephraim and Manasseh? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky points out that it's because Ephraim and Manasseh were born outside of their ancestral homeland, far away from the support and inspiration of their family, they would require an extra dose of chizik and warmth. So it's not that he loved Ephraim and Manasseh any better. It's just that he saw that Ephraim and Manasseh needed a different modality of grandparenting than the other grandchildren. And therefore, he says, children may think that they want to be treated equally, But in truth, everyone wants to be recognized for the ways in which they are special and one of a kind. No one wants to be seen as a carbon copy of their sister or brother. To that end, the objective of parents is to recognize the unique identity of each child and structure their parenting to help each child maximize their individual potential. When Yosef presented his two children to Yaakov, he placed Menashe on the right and Ephraim on the left, in anticipation of the manner that they would be blessed. But Yaakov, we know, flips his hands. Listen to what he does to this. It's so beautiful, right? He asked the question, why didn't he just move the grandchildren? Why did he have to go like this? Wouldn't it have just been easier to have moved Ephraim and Menashe around? So on page number 4, listen to what he says. Why did Yaakov awkwardly cross his arms when administrating the blessings to his grandchildren instead of simply repositioning the boys by asking them to swap places with one another? Gavaldik Akasha. He answers, the Chizkuni explains that in educating children, we cannot ask the child to move from here or there or to change their unique identity. Our objective is to meet the child where they are. And that is a beautiful imagery. Isn't that a beautiful, I thought it was like amazing. If he moved them around, he would basically be saying, you have to change to accommodate me. Instead, he says, no, you are who you are, and I'm going to accommodate my grandparenting style to meet your unique set of needs. Our objective is to meet the child where they are and to cater their specific needs and challenges, even if it requires us to awkwardly adjust our initial plan. The imagery that comes into my mind is, you know, there's like a famous story about Rabbi Soloveitchik, where Rabbi Soloveitchik, someone was talking to him and he mentioned like a sports score or something. And the Rav said, like, you follow the Boston Red Sox? He goes, no, but I wanted to be able to talk to my grandchildren about something that is going to be relatable to them. Right? So again, that's part of like, we accommodate ourselves to them, to meet them where they are, instead of forcing them to meet us where we are. He says in a recent podcast, Rabbi Daniel Kalish, the Masifta of Waterbury, who's going to be in Boker Ton Synagogue February 1st, related that he once asked whether a certain yeshiva is lechatchila, ideal, or bidiyeved, only in response to a given reality. He responded cleverly by saying that, quote, in chinuch, lechatchila is pasul bidiyeved, which means in education, the ideal is disqualified absolutely. Every parent has hopes and dreams for their children and should encourage them to maximize their potential. But ultimately, every parent should also recognize that their style of chinuch must always be in response to the individual identity of each particular child. It would be wrong and unwise to attempt to impose a theoretical, quote-unquote, ideal institution on a child who is unsuited for that approach or method. So there's no ideal set of chinuch because you're going to have to adapt what chinuch looks like for each child or grandchild. I might have my ideal of what it looks like, but if my child might be a little bit different in a certain way or another way, I'm not going to just stay rigid in my ideal, but rather I'm going to be flexible in adapting chinuch for that child or grandchild. That is chanoch lenar al pi darko. I think this is a very beautiful idea. Obviously, it takes the four parshios, positions them together. How is it that Yaakov shows favoritism? How is it that Yosef makes the same mistakes? How is it that Yaakov seems to do it with the grandchildren? The answer is none of them are playing favoritism. They're actually teaching us a profound lesson in chinuch, which is that you have to mold chinuch towards that child and towards the unique talents and abilities and challenges that that child will face. So because Yosef was going to be in a unique situation, Yaakov treats him differently. And because Ephraim and Menashe were going to be in a unique situation, Yaakov treats them differently. And because Binyamin is different as well, Yosef treats him differently. It's not that they're showing favoritism, but rather it's a beautiful lesson in chinuch, which is that we have to adapt our vision of chinuch towards what the child is like, and not try to mold them into what we have as set as our ideal. And again, I think the imagery of Yaakov crossing his arms rather than moving the grandchildren is the most beautiful of the imagery, because what he's saying is, instead of me making you change, you guys stay who you are, and I'm going to amend my vision of chinuch, even if it means an awkward crossing of my arms, to adapt to your unique needs in your unique challenges. That is Rabbi Daniel Stein. Again, I think it's a beautiful idea. I think it'd be a very powerful conversation at a Shabbos table. First of all, I think it'll be a funny conversation, but I think a very powerful conversation about what the obligation of parents are towards children, what the obligation of mechanchim is, what the obligation of grandparents are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's idea number 2. We are running way behind. Idea number 1 came from the Acharei Ro'i, about whether you play to your strengths or your weaknesses. Idea number two, Rabbi Daniel Stein, what is chinuch and what is not chinuch? Idea number three comes from this beautiful sefer, Mima'amakim. We know that when they come to Mitzrayim, Paro says, where are you going to go? You're going to get a part of the land and it's going to be called Goshen. Why are you going to be in Goshen? So we all know the answer is because okay, because the flock, they have shepherd, it was the most expansive of the lands, and so we're going to be in Goshen. The other popular answer is, why do they go to Goshen? Because is it far or close to it's Chutz L'Machane. In other words, if you're going to settle, don't settle in Times Square, settle in Lakewood, right? Be a little away from the city life so that you're not exposed, that was just an analogy, so that you're not exposed to the dangers of being in the middle of Times Square, okay? That is what we know to be the case of Goshen. Yehuda's here for the hot dog. You can come in and take. You don't even have to be here for this year. Okay. Listen to what the Sefer Mima'amakim does. I know, I scared him away. Okay? Sefer Mima'amakim. Turn to page number 6. I'll skip the beginning. He quotes the Medrash. And the Medrash says, I've never seen this Medrash before, but the Medrash says that when Sarah is taken by Paro. Let's go all the way back to Sefer Bereishis. Remember, Avram and Sarah go down to Mitzrayim. Paro thinks that it's the sister, so he takes Sarah. And according to the Medrash, he makes Sarah a deal. He says, Sarah, if you marry me, this is Paro to Sarah, if you marry me, according to the Medrash, Paro says, I'll give you a great dowry. It's called Goshen. I'm going to give you Goshen, and that's going to be a place of great wealth and prosperity, and you, Sarah, as your reward for marrying me, is going to be living in Goshen. Says the Medrash on page number 6, where I have the underline on the bottom, V'kasav las eretz Goshen la'achuza. He gave Sarah as a gift, if she wanted to marry Paro, as an inheritance, the land of Goshen. Says the Medrash, L'fichach yashvu Yisrael be'eretz Goshen, shehi shel Sarah imenu. Therefore, we dwelled in Goshen because it belonged to Sarah Imenu. Ask the Sefer Mima'amakim, I hope, a question that all of you are struggling with. What's the connection? Okay, so because Paro offered Sarah as an achuza Goshen, therefore, hundreds of years later, we end up in Goshen because Paro promised it to Sarah. What does one have to do with the other? What's the connection between the two of them? That should be the question that certainly was in my mind, and I would imagine in your mind as well. Says the Sefer Mima'amakim, whose name is Alexander Aryeh Ben Simcha Mandelbaum. And he writes the following beautiful idea. Think about what Paro was really promising Sarah. He wasn't just promising her a piece of land. He was saying, Sarah, if you go to Goshen, you are going to be showered with riches and wealth and prosperity. Goshen wasn't just a place. Paro said, if you go to Goshen, it'll be the wealthiest of places. And what does Sarah say? She has a choice now. She can marry Paro, or she can do what? Go back to Avram Avinu. She can reject Paro's wealth and prosperity and choose Avram Avinu instead. She makes that choice. She rejects all of that prosperity. She rejects the pull of wealth. And instead, she goes back to Avram Avinu, okay? Says the Sefer Mima'amakim, that is the exact decision that the Jewish people have now in Mitzrayim. The Jewish people have in Mitzrayim, when they go to Goshen, what essentially the Medrash is telling us is that the Jewish people had a choice to make, that they were going to go to Goshen. They were going to go to Mitzrayim. Now, why were they in Mitzrayim? Because what did Yosef give them? Yosef gave them something that other people didn't have, which was food. Remember, there was a famine going on. And everyone's starving. And Yosef says, you guys go to Goshen, and I'm going to take care of you there. All the grains that we've been harboring all these years, I'm going to make sure that you guys are taken care of. And so he says, the Jewish people now have a tug and pull. There's going to be a tension. That on the one hand, they're going to be pulled by wealth and prosperity. And on the other hand, they're going to have to separate themselves from Egyptian culture and Egyptian society and say that even though we're living in Egypt, we are going to be different. And it's Goshen where that tension plays itself out. He says here on page number 7, where I have the arrow, Sarah Imenu lo niftatata lepitoi paro. She wasn't seduced by Paro's seduction. V'nishara ne'mana l'Avram ba'ala b'ofen muchlad. She remained completely, with complete fidelity towards Avram Avinu. Nimsa she'eretz Goshen afacha l'semel ha'itrachakuk minagoyim. Goshen represents distancing yourself from the nations that you are in. Eretz Goshen misaperet al pituv shel paro. V'shtadlut lo latsud berishto asar. He tries to entrap Sarah. V'zos gam t'muros kohono v'rechusho. V'amidaso akshanit shel Sarah. He promises Sarah all of this wealth, and yet Sarah remains stubborn. And she refuses to come close to Paro, even if it means enormous wealth. Hine kikein goshen lo tarmeliz karvus v'nigashim b'neim. Elehefech li'israchakus muchleletes. Goshen represents that even though you are seducing me with wealth and prosperity, nonetheless, I'm going to choose my values over that wealth and prosperity. He says, now, go to the last page. He says, now you understand what Goshen represents. What is the word gimel shin? Gush. He says, gush represents a kesher. It represents a connection. For example, vayigash, vayishaklo. He drew close to him. What's a gesher? A gesher is a bridge that connects two people, but what happens on the bridge? He says, kasher kol avar nishar ome bimkoma v'shomar yichudo. Each side of the bridge is still its own unique entity, but there's something now that's connecting them. He says that's what it means that they go to Goshen. Perush, in my next underline, kedeli hi badel mea umo ha-mitzrit, hit yashvu klal yisrael ba'osa eret shenit la'asara. To separate themselves from the Mitzrim, they go to the land that was given to Sarah. Kasher hi nivdela miparo, specifically when she chose to be separate from Paro. Shama shel eret zo Goshen. That is why it's called Goshen. Mora al inyana mitzad echadu makom galus. On the one hand, it's a place of exile. V'yesh ba b'chinat shel kesher l'eretz mishubedet. Ach mitzad sheni hi mora al kesher she'enu mivatel. Ayichudim atzdadim. Kesher shebo kol avar nivdal atzmo. On the one hand, it's galus. On the one hand, it's being in exile. But on the other hand, it represents a separation, even within exile. And so says the Sefer Meimamakim. What does it mean that there's a connection between Sarah and them going to Goshen? The same exact test that Sarah faced. It was a test of, do you choose to succumb to the temptations of prosperity and affluence and wealth and what that's going to do to corrupt and erode your values? Or are you going to choose to remain separate, even if it means giving up on that wealth and prosperity and affluence? Sarah makes that difficult decision. She rejects Paro's approach, and instead, she says, I'm going to be different from you. I'm going to go to Avram Avinu. I'm going to go to my tradition, even if it means giving up everything else. And that, says the Sefer Meimamakim, by going to Goshen, the Jewish people confront that exact same dilemma. And by extension, it's the same dilemma we face in our generation as well. A generation that is defined largely by prosperity and wealth and affluence and acceptance. We Jews have a choice to make every single day, which is how much are we going to, quote unquote, assimilate to that culture? How much are we going to succumb to the temptations of wealth and prosperity? And how much is we going to allow that to erode what are our core values? Or are we going to maintain a healthy sense of separation, even if it means giving up on some of the finest that the culture around us is going to try to tempt us with? And so we saw three ideas. Idea number one came from the Sefer Acharei Ro'i. Do you play to your strengths or do you play to your weaknesses? Which one is more important? Idea number two came from Rabbi Daniel Stein, which is that you don't show favoritism as a parent, but rather parenting or grandparenting or chinuch requires you to recognize the individual, unique abilities and challenges of each child and to parent specifically to them. That's not showing favoritism. That is proper chinuch. And idea number three came from the Sefer Meimamakim. What does it mean that Goshen is connected to Sarah Imenu? It's the exact same test that Sarah faced was the test that the Jewish people were going to face in Goshen. And by extension, I believe it's the exact same test that we face nowadays, which is the test of prosperity and materialism and acceptance and wealth. What are we going to do with it? And how are we going to protect ourselves from it? I wish everyone a good Shabbos.